Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Indeed, today is the day. Today is the day the Lord has made. He sends us out to rejoice and be glad in it. We got all kinds of news across the headlines today. We've got international news. We've got news here, right here in the United States. But we've also, you know, we've got news closer to home. And so let me invite you to pay attention today to the news closest to you, to the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Easter proclamation. That is still our charge and our commission, to be sharing the good news of what happened on Easter Sunday, on that first resurrection morning some 2,000 years ago now, on a hill in a place called Israel. And I just think that we can't, by Tuesday of Easter week, have lost sight of Easter. And so let's not lose sight of it. Let's be the people who keep it in the forefronts, not only of our hearts and minds, but keep pressing it out there into the culture and into the conversations of the day. So I saw this headline actually a couple of days ago from Gallup, that now only half or 50% of the U.S. public report that they are members of a house of worship, a church, a synagogue, or a mosque. Now, obviously, the overwhelming majority of those are members of churches, seeing as the percentage of the U.S. population who are Jewish or Muslim is actually fairly small. So we're talking here about a fairly precipitous decline over just the past 20 years in terms of church membership. So in 2013, so just 5 years ago, nearly 60%, 59% of Americans said they were a member of a religious congregation. 10 years prior to that, the number was 70%, actually not even 10 years, just in 1999. So 13 years prior to that. So in the last 20 years, we've dropped 20 points in terms of people aligning themselves as members of a religious congregation. So let me ask this question. And by the way, Gallup has been surveying this particular question since 1938. This is the first time in the history of Gallup's polling that this kind of precipitous decline has been noted in terms of church membership. And certainly the first time that fewer than a majority of the American public have reported belonging to a religious congregation. And so let me ask you, are you a member of a particular church? I have a surprising number of conversations with people who identify as Christians. In fact, people who are in what I would describe as ministries of one variety or another, who are not actively engaged in the life of a particular congregation. And so I just need to ask this question. How can you love the bridegroom if you don't love the bride? And I know some of you will push back and you will say, I love the bride. I just don't like any of the varieties or versions of Christianity, of the church that I find in my, in my neighborhood. Okay, well, then it's time to start a house church, because you cannot be a Lone Ranger Christian. It's not actually a thing. I mean, you may say to yourself, well, I am a Lone Ranger Christian, and therefore it is a thing. But just because you say it is so does not make it so. You are a part of a body. You are a member of the body of Christ. And in order to be sitting under a teaching and be in accountable relationships with other Christians and actually participate in the mission of the church, you need to be a part of a local congregation. And so if you are among the more than 50% of the U.S. public who are not members of a particular house of worship, I'm going to challenge you as an Easter person to find a church. I'm going to challenge you today. Be an active member of a local congregation in one way or another. And if you need help finding one, I'm sure we can help you do that. Like, literally, you can't find a church? Email me. I will help you find a church. I'm Carmen at myfaithradio.com. I'm going to be right back with Tommy Binion from the Heritage Foundation. We're going to talk about the coming insolvency of Medicare and Social Security. We're going to talk about the ongoing conversations related to the Sri Lankan Easter Church attacks. We're going to talk about the Mueller report. We got a lot on our agenda today, so stick with us here on Mornings with Carmen.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the Capitol City. It's a long, long wait.
Tommy Binion from the Heritage Foundation. Happy Easter.
Good morning. Happy Easter. It's great to be with you.
Good morning. He is risen.
Indeed.
Amen. Amen. I'm going to keep saying it. I realize that there's a lot of people that think Easter is a day. Easter is at least a season. I actually think it's a lifestyle. So I'm trying to be the provocateur of a conversation about being Easter people. We're the Easter people, man. I don't worship Easter, but I do worship Christ. And there you go. So I'm not getting into the Easter worshipers conversation. I'm just advocating the being of Easter people.
That's right. That's right. We had a special.
I mean, you know, everybody's got to have their advocacy thing, right? I'm gonna have that be mine today.
That, I love it. Keep it up all day, and you will inspire, I think, all of your listeners to remember what happened, and to remember what Sunday was about, and to remember what it's about to be a Christian beyond just on Sunday.
Amen. So let's make a strange segue into a conversation about Medicare and Social Security. I'm going to get my eternal security in Jesus, and ultimately he is my great physician. But I will tell you that I probably, among others, was a little disturbed to hear yesterday and then in the news headlines this morning that Medicare and Social Security sort of passed that inflection point, or we're going to pass that inflection point in 2020. Where expenses in both of those will exceed income. That is an unsustainable financial path, and yet we still have lots of politicians advocating not only for the expansion of those programs, but for the additional taxpayer-funded other forms of social programs. So just talk with us about the point in time we find ourselves in terms of Medicare and Social Security, and you know, from your view, what needs to happen?
Well, we're there. We are at the moment that this is a problem that absolutely has to be confronted. I want to be clear: this is a report that comes to Congress annually. This is a red flag, a red flare that the Social Security Administration sends up to the Hill annually to say we are running out of money. You know, there's a commonly held belief that payroll tax comes out of my paycheck, and then it goes and sits in an account with my name on it. And when I turn 65, I will start drawing down from that account. Well, that's not how Social Security works. When payroll taxes are taken out of my account, that money goes to pay for current retirees. My only hope of being able to draw down from Social Security is that there are young people working when I retire that are paying payroll taxes. But because the baby boomer generation is so big and the current generation of people working is slightly smaller than that, there's not enough money. It's an unsustainable model. Social Security, as it has worked, as it was envisioned, does not work in the current status of our population. And so something has got to change. But that something is a difficult question because of the politics, because so many of us are on Social Security or are about to be on Social Security. And every time you open your paycheck, every 2 weeks on a Friday, you see that money coming out. And you really want to see that money again at some point in your lifetime. So changing it is going to be really hard. There's a lot of options on the table. There's a spectrum. On the left, they want to raise taxes. They want to make the current generation of workers pay more. And on the right, they want to change the benefit. Maybe they want to means test it or raise the retirement age or change the benefits so that it is a little more connected to the people who paid into it. But I got to be honest, those possibilities of reform on Capitol Hill seem very far away. It does not seem likely that in the next year or two or few years, those big reforms that will make the system sustainable are on the horizon.
Okay, these people are familiar with the concept of bankruptcy. I mean, are they not? I mean, I...
No, we're $22 trillion in debt. They're not familiar with it. They really don't think... they think that they can sustain the amount of deficit spending. We're going to run a $1 trillion deficit this year. We're going to add another $1 trillion to that national debt that we already have. You know, on the left, there's something called the modern monetary theory, which is where you can go into as much debt as you want and just print money to get out of it, and it won't be a problem because we are the United States. But if our economic system collapses because of a debt crisis, which will absolutely happen, we will no longer be the United States that can rely on our economic stability and economic influence throughout the globe. It's a real problem, but not one where there are political incentives aligned for anybody in Congress to solve. You see, because all of that money is going somewhere. And when it stops going wherever it's going, whoever was getting it is going to get mad. And so the political incentive is to keep this gravy train going. And there are very few of us like me doing the Chicken Little dance about the national debt crisis. And if there were more, the political incentives would be better. But they're just not there right now.
Okay, so Tommy, you and I have now just created like a total acidic experience for people first thing in the morning. Right. And I know that and I recognize that, but I don't think either one of us is trying to be an alarmist in a way that's not reasonable. I actually think we're trying to be reasonable, and we're trying to say to people, we are on a trajectory in both Medicare and Social Security that are unsustainable. We cannot continue going down the path that we are going in the way that we are going. And so something is going to change. And something has to change, and the sooner it changes, the better off we are in terms of actually achieving something that is the least painful. And so I think that, I just want to encourage people to think about this, consider it, actually start talking with your representatives about this. Call your member of Congress and say, I'm alarmed by this, and I want to know across the spectrum of reform models, where you're at and how I can encourage you to, help us get on a sustainable path in relationship to what I view as really important parts of, our social fabric. So be informed on this topic. I do think, Tommy, that there are those who think that, there's always somebody to bail us out. And it's important for people to remember that the government has been the bailout backstop in many ways, and this sort of already is a bailout program, like Medicare, and at least Medicare is, in terms of how do we bail people out who don't have a means to care for themselves? Here's what I want to remind folks. If the United States of America itself is not in a position to bail herself out, the bailout is going to come from beyond the borders. And so when Tommy and I say this is a critical point in terms of what it means to be a people, we the people of the United States of America, that's what we're talking about. We're not saying that redemption is not possible. We're saying that, this is the way redemption works. It comes from the outside. And I'm not sure, in fact, I'm pretty sure Americans do not want to have to rely on an international bailout in terms of these social programs, because then we are beholden to those who bail us out. And so let's just be very mindful of that as we move forward in these conversations. Tommy, I want to get to the conversation about Sri Lanka and the Easter Church attacks, and I want to get your feedback on the Mueller report. So let's take a quick break, and let's hit those two stories in just a minute. I'm talking with Tommy Binion from the Heritage Foundation, and we'll be right back.
Lord, you are good, and your mercy endureth forever.
Tommy Binion from the Heritage Foundation is here with me this morning. You can check out what he's doing at Daily Signal. You got a lot of great stuff posted today at dailysignal.com. I'm noting their coverage related to the Easter Church attacks in Sri Lanka. I've been reading this morning the death toll now stands at 320 with another 500 people injured. The government of Sri Lanka is saying that these acts were in retaliation for the shootings at mosques in New Zealand. The coordination and sophistication suggests that this local extremist group certainly had international ties and probably some sort of help. And it appears, based on the other devices that they've found all over the country, there was a whole lot more planned. And at least one part of the Sri Lankan government knew this was coming. They certainly didn't know it was going to be this horrific, but they knew this was coming and didn't notify the part of the government that could have done something about it. So let's just wade in wherever you want to on the issues related to the terror attack in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot there, but the thing that I think is most important or is most worthy of our focus today is that Christians are under attack. I don't want to wade into the Easter worshiper debate, but this is an attack on Christians. It was an attack on Christians. It was an attack on foreigners in Sri Lanka. It is an attack on people of faith and our way of life. And, terrorism is always an attack on our current way of life. That's what it's meant to do. It's meant to disrupt us and to change us and to make our current way of life unsustainable and to change it in some way. That is why they want to kill as many people as possible, is to make the way that we are currently living impossible. It is, of course, a heartbreaking situation. 320 of our fellow human beings were victims of this. Countless families were victims of this, and it seems like it should have been or could have been or would have been with a higher level of security to some degree preventable. And so that's what we need this morning is a conversation about refocusing on the global war on terror and understanding that it is still a constant threat, understanding that the nature of the threat hasn't quite changed. The names of these extremist groups change, but really who they are, what they're about, they don't really change that much. And what is necessary to stop them also doesn't change that much. So I hope that we can get to the bottom of whether or not there was a lack of coordination within the Sri Lankan government. It seems like there was, and it seems like that needs to be improved. But we need to understand two things this morning. One is that this was an attack on Christians on Easter Sunday on purpose, and let that sink in for a minute. And the other is that we are still engaged in a global war on terrorism.
And both Fox News and the Wall Street Journal have pieces posted today if folks want to read more about, you know, what Tommy just pointed out. This is a deliberate attack on Christians. Let's not delude ourselves otherwise. And there are things that need to be done in terms of renewing our commitment and the global commitment to fighting not only a battle of ideas, because that's where it certainly starts. But when ideas are carried out in this way, the impact is genuinely horrific. Hey, let's make a transition here quickly to the Mueller report. You and I, why don't you just give us your top line assessment?
Well, it's out and it's exactly what Attorney General Barr said it would be. It says that there is no evidence of whatever collusion is, and it put that worry or concern to rest. Collusion is no longer a thing that we need to be concerned happened. It was a thorough investigation, and it has put that argument to rest. It also looked at obstruction of justice. It's not clear that the special counsel or even the Department of Justice had the ability to indict the president, even if they had found obstruction of justice, but they didn't. They found mixed results, evidence on one side and the other. By the way, there's no secret evidence. All the evidence were things that the president did in the public eye. And it's Mueller basically saying, here's what he did. You decide whether it's obstruction of justice. And the Department of Justice said, of course, it's not. And it's time to move on. I think that the left is probably disappointed in this. We could see that a lot of their political strategy depended on this investigation yielding that the president did something he shouldn't have or did something criminal, and that did not occur. That does not appear in this report. And so I think even though the left is disappointed, as a nation, we can be happy about this and we can move on and we can go about the business. We've got a year and a half of important governance to do before the election. We just talked about a really alarming fiscal situation in this country, which is the Social Security and Medicare solvency problems and the national debt. We need to move on to focusing on those things and away from this failed effort, I would call it, to try and score political points with an investigation.
Tommy, thanks so much. As always, friends, you can join him on LinkedIn. He is Thomas Binion on LinkedIn. You can also find him at heritage.org and at dailysignal.com. Thanks, man. We appreciate it.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. He is risen.
Indeed. Have a great day.
You too. All right, friends, I got to take a quick break to lighten up, and then we'll be right back. So we've got a listener who texted in that they don't really appreciate the emphasis on, recognizing that terrorism is what it is and that it is terroristic and that it strikes fear into people's hearts and lives. Do not fear, my friends. Do not fear. I mean, God's overcome it. I mean, that's where we spent our time yesterday in talking about these attacks, that it's actually relevant that it happened on Easter Sunday, not intending to provoke fear, intending to provoke both an acknowledgement that God is sovereign and that sin is real and that the need for Christ to come continues and persists today. The depravity of the human heart is great, and it's always seeking new ways to do evil. And so be vigilant, but don't be afraid. Be vigilant, but don't be afraid. Let that be the watchword of the day. Jesus did not deny the existence of Satan nor Satan's power in this world, and neither will I. I'm not going to be afraid, but I'm also not going to fail to recognize the reality of it. Okay, so we have got lots ahead. We're going to talk with Dr. Rosemary Stein this morning about a report that was recently sort of shot across the bow of the culture related to kids with anxiety and how parents are learning to let them actually face their fears as opposed to protecting them always from everything. So if you're interested in a conversation about kids and anxiety, that is coming up with Dr. Rosemary Stein. Also, a little later in the program today, we're going to hear from Nicole Phillips, another kindness story. And Peter Kapsner will be back. He and I are going to continue tilling the soil of the 50 Shades of Truth here on Mornings with Carmen. So we'll be right back. So, as you are making your summer plans, you might consider that book that's actually still in your head and in your heart and how you might go about getting it out of there onto paper and then into print. So, on July 12th and 13th at the University of Northwestern St. Paul, we are hosting the Northwestern Christian Writers Conference. That's right, your friends at Faith Radio are a part of hosting the Northwestern Christian Writers Conference. It is an opportunity for you to meet one-on-one with literary agents or publishers or another author to gain some personalized feedback on your writing and the book that's in you and how to get it out of you and onto paper and then into print. So register now, NorthwesternChristianWritersConference.com. Again, it's July 12th and 13th at the University of Northwestern, St. Paul.
Missional drift. It happens when you set out to do one thing and end up doing quite another. This is Jim Garlow, and missional drift is exactly what's taking place in our culture today. We're becoming a culture of the acculturated, unfortunately, even in the church. To be acculturated means complying with the culture in which we live. Ask yourself, are you in any way compromising or becoming attuned to the world's ways at the expense of God's ways? A lack of discernment, and certainly in many cases, a lack of biblical literacy is a huge problem. If we don't know what the Bible says, if we don't understand what God's ways really are, we end up drifting towards supporting our own opinions or the world's so-called tolerance. We need to get back to foundational, righteous issues and principles. If we don't, we'll just continue to drift, compromising God's truth and God's ways. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Sugar helps the medicine go down, medicine go down.
That is the walk-up music for Dr. Rosemary Stein. Dr. Rose, welcome back.
Good morning, Miss Carmen. How are you?
Good morning. Well, you know, I am an Easter person, so on this side of Easter, I am pretty excited.
That's wonderful. Easter is so vivid and bright and cheerful. I just love Easter. It tells us that all things are new again, doesn't it?
Amen. And that even though we face anxiety and fear, ultimately we've got hope that's secure. So I was reading this NPR article, and it's talking about kids with anxiety and how parents are learning to let them face their fears. When we think about, you know, children with anxiety, first of all, that seems crazy. Why are children experiencing such a high level of anxiety in the culture today?
Well, and I think that mostly it's because we're not letting our children face any of the difficult moments. So because of that, they have the opposite of what we would expect them to, which is more anxiety, because they don't think that they can face things, and they don't know what's on the other side. And since they haven't faced anything that stretches them a little bit, then they have no knowledge of you're going to be okay. I see this in the practice all the time. I see kids that are 8 or 9, and they just can't get over just the fear of the unknown. And until you walk a child holding his hand and then maybe sometimes just sort of letting go just a little bit, the kid has no self control, no feelings of I can do this.
So I feel like I'm always telling kids, you can do this. I'm encouraging them to do it. I'm always encouraging independence and sort of capability, and not fearlessness in terms of unreasonable fearlessness, but for kids to try it and try it themselves, and if they fail, try again with some encouragement and maybe some counsel how to do it the next time. How is it that we've got a generation of parents who instead think they have to insulate their children, I mean, for a really long period of time, even up to and through college, insulate them from anything bad, which is ultimately impossible to do?
Yeah, absolutely, because then you still have to face it, and then you're just one big puddle of liquid that just melts into the floor. But see, the thing is, when we as neighbors or a doctor tells the children, our patients, our neighbor, you can do this. Well, the parent goes one step ahead and they show the child that they can do this, and you have to live it with them. And so the parents today don't understand, I have to actually show my child. I have to take the time to actually go through this with them and then say, now you do it. And I have to sit still and see you suffer. You know, with all pain comes goodness. We just learned this from Easter, right? There's no gain without the pain. You actually are the person who has to have the pain, parent, to be able to get to the other side and to be able to have that kind of gain for your child. And it's so like we're not willing or able, or we can't sit in our chair and see them go through that pain before we see the gain in the child. And we have to.
So you recently posted on your Facebook feed, which let me just encourage people to follow Dr. Rosemary on Facebook. She's Rosemary Stein, MD. That's actually the best place to hear what she's talking about day in and day out. And you recently posted about just the lifelong process, particularly of parents with children who are born with special needs. There's this lifelong process of being sure that they are able to function with a level of independence and self-sufficiency into adulthood. And I was really struck by the juxtaposition of that approach to the alternate approach of people who have children who are quite able and quite capable, but who are being protected from actually becoming self-sufficient or independent by parents who apparently want to keep them dependent. Like I was really struck by the juxtaposition of those two stories on the same day. So talk about what parents can do to help their children become more self-sufficient or independent. And is it an internal need in the parent to keep the child dependent?
Well, and I'm going to answer the question first and then go into the other thing. But no, I don't think so. I think that we're doing it to keep our children inside their comfort zone. And when our children are inside their comfort zone, they don't grow. Just like, let's say, a lamb that is kept, or a veal that's kept inside a little square and they're kept very comfortable, then they won't be able to survive outside of that little fence. Well, our children are the same way. And so when we do that, because it's uncomfortable to us to see them not grow, but to see them have to suffer a little bit and to be uncomfortable. It is very uncomfortable for a parent to see the children sort of just thrash around and not be able to do it. And so we want to do it for them. That's the difference in chores. That's why they have to get through those tedious, difficult chores. So and you were talking about a little bit about Taylor's life. So Taylor was brought to me about, I say, 8 years ago. And this 12-year-old girl could not do anything for herself. She couldn't wash her hair. She couldn't feed herself. She could do nothing with her hands. And I said, okay, autism doesn't make you not be able to use your body. I don't understand why your daughter can't use her fingers and her hands and her arms. Why is this? And she said, well, I just thought that because she was autistic, she couldn't do anything. She told me she couldn't. Oh, my goodness. So for 12 years, we had literally paralyzed Taylor into not being able to do anything. I said, okay, let's put an end to this, and let's start having her use her things. Well, she went into fits of rage and temper tantrums because she didn't want to do anything for herself. But we had kept her in that place, and she was rebelling against what would give her life. And so her mom said, she can't do this. And I said, she can. Give it time, give it patience, give it prayer. And so over the last 8 years, we have been developing a girl. And now she's able to go to the Salvation Army and put things on hangers and take them off and put their tickets on and put them in the right place. She can write. She can speak to the point of being able to make a coherent sentence. She is very loving, so somebody would hire her when mama is not there anymore. Well, we do that the same thing to kids who are fully capable and functional, and we're making them smaller than they need to be because we're not giving them life in being able to see them through their struggle. So that's the same thing that we were talking about with the anxiety.
All right, Dr. Rosemary, let's return to this conversation in just a minute, but let's go a slightly different direction, and let's talk about kids and technology and behavior issues and this level of like gross inactivity among our kids. So that's coming up next here as we continue our conversation with Dr. Rosemary Stein. You can find her on Facebook, Rosemary Stein, MD. We'll be right back.
Hallelujah. You have overcome. You have overcome.
So how much time do your kids or grandkids spend on electronic devices that have screens every day? I want you to consider that question. I want you to consider how in your family screens, devices with screens, are used. Are they used cooperatively? Are you, as a parent, sitting with your child, particularly if they are preschool age, sitting with your child as they are consuming whatever is on the screen or interacting with it? Or are you using it as a way of getting them distracted by something so you can do something else? This new study out of the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada, is pretty striking. I'm going to let Dr. Rosemary Stein tell us about it in terms of how much time and at what age our children should be spending on devices that have screens and why that is.
Well, thanks for asking that question, Ms. Carmen. And I always tell parents that the less that we can expose our small children, so a preschool age, 4 and less, to screen, the better. So my preference is, this is going to sound crazy, not at all. Even when the little eyes are looking at the screen for, let's say, 5 minutes, and you hardly ever give the child the screen, they are just immediately fixated to the screen. You take that phone away, and they go into a fit of rage. It is almost naturally addictive to the child's brain. This is what I see all the time. And they look, the parent looks over at the kid and says, how is it that that happens that quickly? I swear the kid does not get the phone or the electronic device ever unless I go out and I'm trying just to entertain him. And I say, I know. Can you imagine leaving him up for an hour or two? It's so damaging to their brain. So my advice may seem completely crazy. The AAP is saying up to an hour. I think that an hour is probably noxious for a brain that's four. These are kids today that were not necessarily on it for an hour or two at a time, and then they're 16 and 17, and you can tell they're zombies. Imagine the tiny ones growing up from the age of two being on the phone for an hour, two, or three a day. So I would say do whatever possible. Fill up a backpack with interesting things to do, with pictures, with crayons, with things that they can handle, with Legos, so that when you go out, the child learns to entertain him or herself and not be entertained by somebody else's idea of what he should be entertained by.
So you're going to appreciate the way this is phrased. ABC News reports it this way. The data in this report from the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada, suggests that between 0 to 30 minutes a day is the optimal amount of screen time. So I thought you would appreciate that they admit that, like, zero is actually optimal. And then we do have, you know, we do have sort of conflicting guidance. And we acknowledge that. But up to 30 minutes does seem to be what everyone is saying is sort of the max for children up to 5 years old. They followed these kids. First of all, I love this phrasing, Dr. Rose. I love that they describe it this way, that they followed these children from mid-pregnancy. First of all, that is some pro-life language right there. And that's some pro-life language that's being reported out by every major news source today. That this report follows children from mid-pregnancy. If we're following children from mid-pregnancy, we're admitting that they are children before they're born. I know. Also, anyway, so following children from mid-pregnancy into adolescence, and they basically chart the screen time, and there's a continual rise in the amount of time that children have on screens over the course of that, and then the impact in terms of the incidence of ADHD. And so tell people what ADHD is and tell people what effect that has on your child once they reach school. And why would we want to, by 7.7 times more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD if a child by the age of five is spending more than 2 hours of screen time each day? So, I mean, we are contributing to a 7.7 times more likely incidence of ADHD among our children if we expose them to screens for more than 2 hours a day at the age of five. Tell us what ADHD is and why that matters to their educational success.
Well, first of all, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is childhood. Attention deficit, you're telling your kid what to do and they can't. Hyperactivity, they're all over the place. And so what I have seen in my patients is that ADHD is the hallmark of a young child. It means that their brain is immature. And by leaving them on the phone, we are allowing their brain to remain more immature than their age would signify because we're not exposing them to all of the different things. Now, some brains are naturally going to be more ADHD because they might be a little bit more right brain than left brain, more creative. They go into their brain. They think about like 10 things at the same time. But it's not normal for a brain to be this immature. We're allowing the brain to be more immature by exposing them to this unlimited or excessive phone and digital time. And so that's why we have so many children. We're not exposing them. Once again, it goes to the same thing. There's no pain. There's no gain. So we're leaving their children inside of the comfort zone. It's very easy for a child to be inside a phone, not to have to talk, not to have to do chores, not to have to expose themselves to the world and grow. And so therefore, we are allowing them to be excessively immature.
And I just, you know, then I just immediately think that part of that is we as parents not wanting the pain of having to learn or relearn or learn new skills in relationship to relating to our own kids and our own time management and the increasing demands in our own lives. So I think it's complex. Thank you for helping us wade through it. Thank you for everything that you do every day to equip us. Again, you guys can find Dr. Rosemary Stein on Facebook, Rosemary Stein MD. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. So I appreciate those of you who not only listen, but then engage with us. You can always text me during the show at 877-933-2484. And, you know, tell us what you're thinking about and how you are reacting and responding to the conversations that we're having here. I appreciate this listener who was responding to my comment to Tommy Binion earlier in the program that I felt like we had probably created a lot of acidic response in our listeners in terms of the conversation about the national debt and Social Security. This listener says, yeah, I got that acid dump. I felt the knot building up in my gut when you started talking about the national debt. My brain started racing for an answer for me and my growing family. We've got two grandchildren on the way. I think that that is the right way to think. I think that thinking generationally, I think for our family, we don't just talk about generational planning, you know, among those of us that are the oldest generation. We talk about it with the emerging generations. We talk about it with the adult children, and we have already started talking about it with the generation beyond that. We want to create generational sustainability that's not government dependent. And so read Joseph's testimony in the book of Genesis as a good starting point for your family and the generational sustainable conversation.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.